This is the State of Things broadcasting from the Upstage Cabaret in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. A collection of prints by Henry Matisse at the Wetherspoon Art Museum at UNC Greensboro features the artist's favorite subject, the female form. Matisse is well known for his use of color, but these prints are mostly black and white, and they reveal his overarching desire to create an art of balance and serenity. The prints were purchased after the First World War by Claribel and Etta Cohn, and they're part of the world's largest collection of Matisse's works. Art historian at Guilford's College, Catherine Shields, has studied Matisse during this period, and she joins us now. Catherine, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
And WAM Curator of Collections, Elaine Gustafson, arranged the installation, and she can share with us the story of the Cohn sisters as well. Elaine, good to have you here.
Thank you.
Tell us more about, let's talk about the prints a little bit and where they come from. Where does this part of the collection come from?
This was a gift from, as you said, Etta and Dr. Claribel Cohn way back in 1949. They donated 66 prints by Matisse as well as six sculptures to, at that time, the fledgling gallery that was the Wetherspoon.
That is a familiar name here, Cohn. Tell us about their relationship to the Cohns of Greensboro.
They are the sisters of Moses and Cesar Cohn, who started the denim and jean factory here, textiles in general. And they would visit this area to see their family, and they developed a relationship with the Wetherspoon.
They're from Baltimore.
They're originally from Baltimore, but as I said, they would travel to Greensboro, and their brothers lived here, and in Blowing Rock.
And tell us how the Cohns of Baltimore came to have, I think, was it the largest collection of Matisse?
Yes. When they had a collection of 3,000 objects, 500 of which were by Matisse, and Etta had a very long relationship with Matisse, writing letters and visiting him every summer. From the 20s to his death in the 50s.
So now the Cohns of Baltimore have a very large collection. How did they come to Greensboro?
Well, Etta Cohn was, as I said, involved with the Wetherspoon. Her sister-in-law was Laura Weil, and Laura asked Etta to consider donating a portion of the collection in her will, and that's what she did. She wound up giving us 242 objects from their collection.
So, Catherine, let's talk a little bit about this art. First of all, Matisse, well known for his colors, we're going to see mostly black and white prints. Tell us a little bit about that. What do we determine? What do we know about Matisse when we look at these prints?
This collection of prints is really startling or striking because of the range of line. Like you said, there's not much color, so he had to really focus his visual vocabulary on line for this particular body of work. But there's a huge range. There are some pieces that are really just contour line, just outlines, and then there are others that are richly patterned and decorated and layered. And so there's a huge range. So the same kind of expressive vocabulary or expressive language that you spoke about with his color that you might expect in his paintings or in some of his other prints, you can see here happening, that sort of vibrancy happening in the line.
Matisse was intentional and outspoken about color and the power of color. He really loved for that to be the thing that got your attention and got to your heart, the emotional power of it. So which came first with him?
Well, I think in terms of the revolutionary nature of his work, color stood out the most because he used color in a non-naturalistic way early on. And so when he was part of the Fauve group, they were called wild beasts. And so the color that didn't match what we would see in the world around us really stood out. But line came along with it because along with exaggerations in color, he was also exaggerating line. And you really see that happen throughout his career. He continues to use color in an expressive way, line in an expressive way. And during this period, during the 20s, he's really, like you said, looking at the human form and really concentrating on what he sees in front of him. And this leads to the next phase of his work, the contour line drawings foreshadow the next real huge revolutionary development in his career, which happened in the 30s, which was his paper cutouts, where color and line sort of become one again. They're sort of pulled back together.
Tell us what's going on in the world of art at the time Matisse is doing this work.
Okay, so in the 20s, let me start with Matisse. Matisse was actually in Nice. He was not in Paris. Paris is sort of the center of the art world at this time, and he has gone to Nice for a break, really, for a respite, away from the world events that are happening. And where in the early 20th century, we saw a lot of artists exploring abstraction and doing some of the more revolutionary things. In the 20s, artists really go back to more classical subjects, and they go back to, for example, the classical subject of the nude, where, you know, in the École des Beaux-Arts, that's what they would be studying. They would be drawing from life and drawing from the nude. And so this is one of the subjects that artists are returning to in the 20s, between the world wars, when the world feels so chaotic. They want something that's a little bit more stable, a little bit more expected. And that's what we see happening in this body of work also.
Well, it's interesting because in some ways Matisse stands out among his colleagues in the world of art, in the modern art world. And he says very deliberately, I desire pleasure, he says. I am not a revolutionary by principle. I was educated in an entirely different manner. While other artists are expressing the horror and shock of the 20th century, Matisse is in some ways trying to create continuity with earlier generations. Am I right in this? Is that a fair assessment, Elaine, would you say?
You are. It goes, as Catherine indicated, back to the history of art and almost back to the Greeks when they started looking at the body and the human form and exploring its expressive
So where does he stand then? I mean, it's an interesting counterpoint to what else is going on in the art world, is to say, and he's deliberate about that too, we don't need to break with, you don't need to kind of commit an artistic suicide to make an artistic or creative statement.
Well, I think it comes back for him to authenticity. I think that he didn't want to be radical just to be radical. I think he wanted to do what felt appropriate to him. He didn't particularly like psychological interpretations of his work. He didn't particularly like people to look into the symbolism. He was really interested in critics. He kind of was kind of direct. He really wanted critics to be descriptive of his work. But I think that speaks a lot to what his intentions as an artist were. He wanted it to be authentic. And I think that really comes through clearly in this body of work, in this body of prints.
What should we be looking for as we see this exhibit and again see the kind of flow and the evolution of his work? What should we be looking for?
Well, I think the range. One thing that I talked about was the range. There was also a group of the title of the show is Matisse and His Muses, and there was a small group of women, especially one model, Henriette Dary-Carrère. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her name correctly, but she was his primary model from 1920 to 1927. So there are a few different identities that you can be looking for. You can also be looking for, like I said, this range from very clear, bold outlines to more patterned and layered imagery.
And remember, it is Matisse who said exactitude is not truth.
Right.
He kept warning people not to look, because people were criticizing him, saying, my kids can do that, right?
I mean,
and even though he's doing kind of simple drawings, it's not simple work at all.
That's very true. He really was a proponent of a combination of seeing and feeling. He also said very famously that he did not create a woman, he made a picture. And that's one of the things that has been very influential, because he was very particular about what he would include in the piece. He doesn't need to include everything. He can really focus our attention on the way that a toe hooks around the back of a knee, or the way that the curve of a calf crosses a chair, or the way that a face might integrate with the pattern of a veil. So those are things that he was seeing. That was the reason to make these images, and that's the reason that we want to see them and we want to remember them.
In that case, he's very contemporary in terms of focusing our attention on the notion of attention itself.
Yes.
Now that we're so easily distracted and so readily distracted, the question of what we pay attention to and how we do and don't becomes a very contemporary kind of an issue.
Absolutely.
Elaine, tell us more about the collection, because this is a fairly large collection that the Weatherspoon has. You have to kind of parse it out and show it to us in doses, right?
Right. And so for this exhibition, I decided to focus on two parts of the theme, which is the female form. One of them, there's several images that are just of women being very pensive in an interior, mainly reading or just looking often in thought. And then there's a second vein, which is what when he went back to looking at the odalisque, which is a fancy term for the nude female form. So you can also, when you're touring the exhibition, see these two types of themes in the exhibition and see how he explored them.
And some are more, as you say, more staid and rested, and others are more sort of in action.
Right.
not in action, but in
and in contorted action. Forms yes. as well, because he was interested in the body and how it moved, and that's why he actually created sculptures as well. So you can see some of the poses are very athletic, while the interior seemed to be a quiet, pensive.
Catherine, you said that he had one model for a fairly long period of time. Mm-hmm. Is that unusual for artists at the time?
Well, I think it was kind of necessary. In Nice, he had a hard time finding models. In Paris, it was very easy. There were people looking for work and wanting to model all the time. In fact, I think the first year he was there, he didn't have a model at all. And that the particular model that I mentioned that he worked with for the majority of that decade was a friend of the family. She was close to his wife. She was close to his children. And she, when she left his employ, left her job to get married, Matisse was actually, he was hurt, and it was difficult for him because this is a collaboration between him and the model. And so to have that, that might have been one of the reasons he stayed with this subject for so long, because he did have this almost like a business relationship, a collaboration.
Interesting, too, to think about. And again, if you think about improvisational art and music also developing at this time, the fundamental theory there is with just a few notes, I can make a lot of changes. So the amount, the diversity, and the fact that he hadn't plumbed all of the subjects and all of the material from one subject tells you something about it.
Just keep looking and keep looking and keep recording and keep,
So why Nice? Why did he leave Paris? That's where the art
beautiful.
Happens, isn't it?
It's beautiful. Yeah. You talked about how he liked pleasure, and I have a quote actually related to the odalisques. Could I read it?
Yeah.
Okay. Look at these odalisques carefully. In this ambiance of languid relaxation, beneath the sun-drenched torpor that bathes things and people, a great tension smolders, a specifically pictorial tension that arises from the interplay of mutual relations of the various elements. I eased those tensions so that an impression of happy calm could emerge from these paintings, a more or less amiable serenity in the balance of deliberately amassed riches. So I think he said it better than I necessarily.
It's a fascinating point. Again, I want to keep coming back to it. It's a time when the whole world of art is trying to reflect the turmoil and the heartbreak of a world gone mad. And he keeps trying to bring us back to it. In fact, he just sort of calming the lines and saying, I know there's a lot of turmoil in the world, but look at this form, look at this
woman.
Look how simple it can be. Yeah. I mean, it's a fascinating. So how was he received in the world of art? Was he well received among his fellow artists?
That's a really good question. Actually, this body of work was shown in 1931 in Paris. And it was seen by a lot of critics as being kind of backwards moving. It wasn't revolutionary. There's no scandal associated with it. There's nothing violent happening. It was kind of boring, and people thought that it got quote unquote lukewarm reception, and it did not propel his career further in any way. And I'm not sure that's what he was looking for at this time. I'm not sure that's what he needed. And like I said, it really preceded the time in the 30s when he's starting to think about outlines in a different way and using the cutouts as as a mode of creation. He wasn't showing them as final pieces at that time for another decade or so, till the 40s. But I think if he hadn't had this time of real sort of quiet reflection and concentrating on this relationship with these models, then he may not have been able to embark on another period of experimentation.
So I guess this lukewarm response from critics who are expecting, where's the angst?
Yes.
On the other hand, then there's a temptation to read stuff into his art that it's ironic in some ways. Were people doing it then or now, critics trying to read things into his art that he might have shuddered?
Oh, sure. And I think that's why he, they talked about the eroticism and the orientalism in a sort of negative way. And he would steer them back to just look at it. Let's describe it. Let's don't interpret it. So I think, again, that was his tendency. And in a way, that sort of narrows the types of readings that he would entertain to begin with.
Elaine, let's talk again more about this collection, the Cohn sisters with their deep from Baltimore, with their deep connection here with the Cohn brothers, Cohn Mills, and of course Levi Jeans, all coming out of here. Tell us about the Weatherspoon, the connection, the deep and long connection between Greensboro, the Triad, and the arts.
Sure. Well, the Weatherspoon was founded in 1941 by the professor, the department head of the art department, because he really felt that to teach the students, he needed to have examples of art of our time. So we have always been involved in the art that's being made of the time, of the day. And the community has also embraced that. We've had support from them from as early as the 40s. As I said, this was a bequest that came to us in 1949. And the community has always visited us and wanted to have this cultural resource in Greensboro.
And there are a lot of great collections here. I mean, you can see art that you might have to travel quite a bit far and wide to see otherwise. But it has been collected over the decades at the Weatherspoon.
Right, and donated to the Weatherspoon, which is, as our tagline always says, we have free admission, free parking, and free thinking. So if you are not able to travel to New York or Los Angeles or Chicago or wherever the big art cities are, you are able to see these pieces here in Greensboro.
How long has the relationship, it's actually at UNCG, but it is a community resource, has that relationship always been that close right from the start?
Yes, completely, yes.
I mean, I guess that speaks about to the value of a public university that can also not only educate its students, but provide a space for this kind of art, both for the donation, to have these collections, and then allow people to come in and see this great art from all around the world.
Exactly.
I want to thank all of you, both of you, for being on the program. Fascinating. When can we see it? So tell us more about the exhibit.
It's up until October 26th, so it's on view right now.
All right. Matisse and his muses, right? And how many pieces altogether?
About 22.
All right. We've been talking with art historian Catherine Shield about Matisse and his life during the 20s. Catherine, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Also with us, the Weatherspoon Art Museum curator, Elaine Gustafson, who is talking about the installation, Matisse and His Muses. You can see the exhibit, as we said, at the Weatherspoon Art Museum until October 26th. Just ahead, we're going to hear and meet the man behind the music of Woe Woeful, Richard James, and we'll hear some of his experimental music, and we'll get a taste of that right now. Please stay tuned.
If he is breakable, to be sure we'll be broken. When it rains, it pours the truth by every token. If it's change you seek, you can find it in the healing wounds of broken things, hearts and minds of people. Towers arise from sin to for your